Welcome back to Batman Nightcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, exploring the bronze and modern age adventures of the Caped Crusader and the Boy Wonder. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
And we're continuing our dual coverage of the 70s Len Wein, Marshall Rogers, Clayface 3 saga, as well as Mark Waid and Chris Samnee's current Batman and Robin Year One series. But before we jump into all of that, any Batman news of note since our last episode, Ryan?
Well, on the podcasting front, Michael Bailey has thrown down the gauntlet and he's now doing like two bi-weekly Batman podcasts. So I think we may have challenged him. I think he's coming it right back in our face.
So. Yeah. Well, and we just sit back and do it monthly and he works himself to death. So that works out. Yeah. So.
Love Michael and Andy. They can't get enough of their podcast, but yeah.
Oh yeah. That's for sure. Yeah. I messaged Andy back and forth cause he mentioned something on his Spider-Man show that I'm like, hey, when did that happen? And we were like talking back and forth. It was actually about when they got rid of the sins past. They retconned that away, thank God. I didn't realize they retconned that. And he like was filling me in because I haven't read a Spider-Man comic in, you know, like 20 years. So, you know.
Like you mentioned, we're going to be covering the second issue of Batman and Robin Year One. By the time our listeners hear this episode, I believe issue 12, the final issue, will be out. I had to catch up. I read issues 10 and 11 this afternoon before we were recording this. The series is good. So I'm really looking forward to the finale.
Yeah, it's a shame it's ending. I wish they do, you know, year two. But, you know, I'm sure, you know, Mark Waid's plenty busy and Chris Samnee probably. I think he, you know, probably needs a good lead time to work steadily month to month. So, you know, we'll probably have to wait for any kind of follow-up if they do one, you know, which I think Batman and Robin probably survived this series. That's just my guess, though. I don't know.
I don't know. It's pretty close. I'll just say there could be imposters. Maybe it was somebody else the whole time.
That's true. Yes.
The one other thing, the Batman novel that came out last year, Batman Resurrection, which was written by John Jackson Miller, it's set in the world of Tim Burton's Batman movies. It takes place right after the 89 movie, and it's still dealing with the fallout of Joker's, like, Smilex toxin and in the city streets and all of the stuff going on after the Joker's killed. Yeah, there's some familiar Batman characters that kind of come up in it, but it also, it's like our first glimpse of Max Schreck and some other characters that we won't see until Batman Returns. It was a really cool book. I hope you get a chance to read it because I'd like to talk about it at some point. But anyway, John Jackson Miller is doing a sequel coming out maybe this month, and it's called Batman Revolution. It's another one before Returns, but after Resurrection, and I think this one is going to introduce that version of the Riddler.
Oh, nice. So it's going to be a different, it's not going to be the Jim Carrey Riddler. It's going to be.
No, it's Tim, this is treating the Tim Burton movies as separate from the Joel Schumacher movies.
Ah, okay. Well, that probably makes sense because it's, you know. Right. Yeah. So it's going to be maybe kind of Robin Williams is the Riddler.
Reading the description, they give a, I think there's something familiar about the Riddler's origin in this that I wonder if it's been done this way before, but I can't remember.
Okay. Yeah, I need to read that book. I think I might put that on my Christmas list for because, you know, I'm in that period now where I'm like told, don't buy anything, you know, unless it's something that's going to sell out. Don't buy anything because we need to buy you stuff for Christmas. And I'm like, okay. and birthday. So I think I'll put that on my Christmas list because I do want to read that because based on your recommendation and everything else I've heard, but especially your recommendation, I think I'd really dig it. So I definitely need to
get the audiobook. You don't have to listen to that many podcasts anymore.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's right. speaking of Max Schreck, I'm going to get on my soapbox here for a minute. You and I have had many discussions and quite a few with our pal, David A. Gutierrez, about toys. We're all toy collectors. And I'm really getting fed up with Todd McFarlane's business practices. It's breaking me. I just, you know, he puts out the Batman Returns line. It's available like, you know, your usual retailers like, you know, Big Bad Toy Store, Entertainment Earth, and those places and McFarlane's store. And then he has several exclusives like the Penguin and the Duck is available, I think, just at GameStop, period. Then the Penguin Commandos were just McFarlane store exclusive. And Max Schreck is a red platinum, which, you know, McFarlane comes up with these crazy, weird designations for chase figures because McFarlane is really trying to create that 90s BS that made him a millionaire, basically, in comics, you know.
He doesn't know any other way.
Doesn't know any other way, apparently. And Max Schreck is at GameStop supposed to be at first, just for online. You can't order him anywhere else. But you might be able to find him, if you're lucky, at a Target or a Walmart or something. I sat there and, you know, dutifully waited. I ordered the other three off Big Bad Toy Store, Batman, Catwoman, Penguin. Max Schreck came and went, never even saw him. It was like he wasn't up, and then it was like basically not available, not available, not available. Same thing happened like a week or two later with the Super Friends figures with Jaina. They released Zan of the Wonder Twins as a regular release, but then Jaina and Gleek, as of Chase, that's just evil. What does one Wonder Twin, they literally can't use their powers without the other one. So they're useless without, some people think they're useless, period. I know. I'm not one of those people. I think Marvin's useless. But the Wonder Twins, you know, I'd like to have figures of them. But it's like, damn it, McFarlane, I have money to give you. Why are you making it so hard for me to give you money? You know, so, and I know other...
He won't have the DC license for very much longer.
Just I know, but like you told me, he has said he's got it through the end of 2026. And we thought he was going to maybe just go through the first few months, but apparently he's got it through the end of 2026. And despite liking a lot of what they've done in recent years, the first few years of what they put out, I really didn't care for. But, you know, they kind of like, oh, wait a minute, these old guys like the older versions of the characters and the... You know, the actor versions from the movies that were out back then and things like that. And they started making stuff to appeal to us that's not, you know, death metal armpit or whatever it is. I don't even know what that stuff is. But, you know, I know a lot of toy companies are doing similar tactics. But I think McFarlane takes it to the next level of just ridiculousness of just like, oh, nope, you literally... didn't get the two figures that were available online at GameStop for like 2 seconds, you know? So that's my rant. I just wanted to have I had a public forum to gripe about it. So I took it. So there you go.
Understandable.
But like I said, I think I am going to start paring down what I get from McFarlane and place like this. I'm just tired of being frustrated about it. You know, this just isn't worth like getting, it's not, there's way more things to worry about, people. I understand that. I'm not, it doesn't bother me that bad, but it's just, it's ridiculous that it's a horrible business model, in my opinion. I don't understand why a company would want to, I've never understood why any company wants to basically support the aftermarket, you know, like make the aftermarket prices of things go up. I've never understood that. So whatever.
But I also think some of his figures are just really bad. Like, he doesn't understand like how to scale figures. Like you got like the Power Girl figure is bigger than or taller than half of the men figures that he's made and everything like that. It's just like he makes his figures the way he drew comic books. And it's like a lot of times it's like, wow, that's a really striking image. I can see why he's so successful. And other times his figures, like his comics, I'm like, the hell am I looking at? I don't even understand that.
Good point. Yeah, I mean, like the Wesley Dodd Sandman, for instance, that figure is ugly. The paint on it is what's just, I mean, when did he ever look like that? It's like, what? You know, I mean, you could have went by any number of the ways they interpreted in Sandman Mystery Theater. Or in the Golden Age, I don't know where they got that color scheme from. It's like
I think it's supposed to be based off of the, I think it was Riley Rossmo cover of the Wesley Dodd Sandman miniseries that came out a few years ago. So that's kind of where the colors are from. But even then, they're kind of taking. I don't think they knew who the character was or had ever read that comic. His jacket, his trench coat looks like it's got weathered, like it's a leather jacket. His gas mask is all black. And the eyes, the lenses of his mask are bright orange and yellow. That's because on the cover, they're reflecting fire. That's not what the lenses are supposed to look like. And the head, like he doesn't have a neck. It's like it's a bad figure, and it's also like he just reused the body of like the Question and slapped on a new head, new paint. So.
Yeah, and we joked about the one, the Batman Incorporated. And I will say, I know we're not doing feedback, but Brett Young, yes, I did misspeak. Batman did wear the yellow oval again during the Batman Incorporated comics. And I did know that. I had a brain fart. So I did know that. But
Right, because it could light up when he goes to bat raves.
right, exactly. And McFarlane chose to illustrate this by putting like a spray of yellow paint around it, which makes it look like Batman just stopped the Batmobile at a hot dog cart and had an accident. You know, and Alfred, of course, they killed Alfred now, so he has nobody to wash his shirt. So now Batman runs around with a mustard stain all over his costume now. So that's where we are in modern comics, I guess. But
Oh man.
yeah. Well, let's talk about an older comic. How's that? Let's talk about
Sure.
Batman did wear el yellow oval all the time. Let's jump into Detective Comics number 478, was released April 27th, 1978, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. The story is called The Coming of Clayface 3, which, like we mentioned, he's making sure you know he's the third Clayface. Not one, not two, but three. Covered by Marshall Rogers and Terry Austin, his former inker, in a subway tunnel, Batman holds the clothing of what was once a woman, her gooey remains oozing out of them. In the foreground, on the other side of a wall, we see the dripping hand of someone watching the Caped Crusader. The text reads, "Clayface is back," and Batman adds, "And this girl was his first victim." A text box reads, "You, Batman, will be his next." So what do you think of the cover?
I like it. It's kind of busy with a lot of text on it, but that doesn't bother me. It is more of a representative cover. This scene does not exactly show up in the comic. I mean, I guess I wish we could see more of Clayface actually on the cover. We really only get the side of his like hand and the clay fingers, but it is setting up the mystery, and we get plenty of looks at him inside. So it's a good cover. I don't love it, but it's not bad. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised the Comic Code Authority let someone get turned to goo on the cover, you know, and just like falling out of their clothes. But I also had a Legion of Superheroes comic around this time where Saturn Girl was turning into dust. So I guess it's okay, you know, if you probably can't show anybody getting shot or stabbed, but you can show them, you know, literally turning into like protoplasm or dust. So
It is
good
a
enough.
horrific image. Like, I guess the now that I looked at it the way you think about it, like I can kind of see a little bit of an EC Comics bent to it, the kind of skewed angle and everything like that. Like this could have been a
Yeah.
horror comic if you just replaced Batman with somebody else.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely what Clayface does, and we'll get into, is very horrific. So, oof. So again, the story was called The Coming of Clayface 3. The writer was Len Wein. Marshall Rogers and Dick Giordano were the artists. Ben Oda, the letterer. Marshall Rogers was also the colorist on the original version. And the editor was Julius Schwartz. Batman interrupts a robbery of exotic fish from the Gotham Aquarium and gives the two criminals more than they bargained for. Distraught over Silver St. Cloud leaving him, the Dark Knight lashes out until the police intervene. Across town at Star Labs, another robbery is in progress. A retired cop, now a security guard, fires upon the hooded and cloaked thief, damaging his loot. The being we'll know as Clayface 3 disarms the guard but leaves him be until the burning fever that plagues him returns. And he releases it by grabbing the guard's head, who lets out a blood-curdling scream. When he returns to his home at the Wayne Foundation penthouse, Bruce Wayne is so upset over Silver's departure, he blames his parents for dying and cursing him with the life of the Batman before begging for their forgiveness. He doesn't have long to ponder the idea of actually leaving his Batman life behind for long, though, because Commissioner Gordon and the Bat-Signal beckon. Gordon shows Batman the liquid remains of his old friend and former cop, Henry Matlock, similar to the homeless man they found nights before. Even more curious is the muddy message the murderer left behind: "Forgive me." At the abandoned Father Knickerbocker Wax Museum, Clayface has dinner with his lovely companion, Helena. He relates how he, Preston Payne, was born with acromegaly, which distorted his body and features. He was shunned by his schoolmates as a boy and, despite his genius, by his scientific colleagues as an adult. No plastic surgeon could change his appearance, but he took note of a headline about Matt Hagen, the shape-shifting criminal known as Clayface. Speaking to him in prison, Hagen didn't offer any information on how his amazing powers worked, but he did provide a blood sample. Payne isolated the malleable properties in Hagen's blood, and like any good comic scientist, injected himself with the results. After a fiery pain that caused him to pass out, it seemed to work. Payne could reshape his features into a handsome visage. He took to the town with a beautiful woman until a stroll in the park turned into a nightmare. Payne's face began to melt, and when he touched his fleeing date, she burned into a pile of protoplasm. Payne was forced to build himself an exoskeleton armor to contain his shifting body and release the occasional fever that overtook him by touching and melting some unfortunate victim. He says without Helena, he would have lost his mind over the whole affair as he strokes the cheek of his wax figure lover. Payne visits another lab, hoping to find the piece he needs for a cure, but the Batman is ahead of him, guessing eventually he would show up for the part he tried to steal from Star Labs. With the strength from his advanced armor, he easily tosses the Caped Crusader aside. But as he takes his leave of him, the burning fever returns. Clayface approaches the still-down Batman, ready to pass the fire onto him. To be continued. What do you think?
It's fun. There are a couple things about the story that really make me think, oh yeah, Len Wein was definitely coming from Marvel and definitely had a Marvel sensibility when he was writing this book.
Yeah, it's melodramatic in a lot of ways. Yeah, that's true. That's part of it, yeah.
I don't remember if this came up. I'm sure it probably did back in the Secret Origins podcast when I talked about the Clayfaces, the whole Clayface issue. And I like all of the different Clayface characters, at least the first three. This one, Preston Payne, Matt Hagen, and Basil Carlo. I like them all. But they're all very different in presentation. Like, they have not only different appearances, but almost different gimmicks and powers. Did they all have to be Clayface? I understand from a publishing standpoint, wanting to keep a name or a trademark. And like, in the same way, I kind of think, okay, like from the way the Golden Age heroes were transposed into the Silver Age, like, you know, Green Lantern doesn't look like the Alan Scott version, and they had kind of different origins, and these guys are all kind of different, but it's like, did this guy have to be Clayface 3? I mean, you can tie his origin to Matt Hagen, but if he's such a different person, like, can you come up with another, like, Hot Hands or something, or some other weird kind of lame name or something like that? But I don't know. Like, I kind of go through this because I still have, like, jumping across the street to Marvel. Like, Monica Rambeau is one of my favorite characters, and I think of her as Monica Rambeau. Because the first Marvel character that I met called Captain Marvel wasn't Monica. And when I met Monica, I was like, why is she called Captain Marvel? Like, she's not connected to Marvel or Carol or their kids or anything like that. Like, why is she Captain Marvel? It's like, well, because they need to keep the name for trademark purposes. And I was like, yeah. I like her more than any of those characters, but I also think she doesn't have to be Captain Marvel. Like, she could be Photon or Spectrum or whatever they're calling her. I just call her Monica. But I'm sort of in the same way. I'm like, I really like this Clayface. I like his design. I like his gimmick. I like his origin. But he doesn't have to be Clayface 3 to me. They could call him a different name and just kind of, it would be easier in my mind to manage it, but it's whatever.
I mean, they honestly could call him Professor Payne, you know, because he's Professor Preston Payne.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, or Dr. Payne.
That works.
yeah. I mean, I think the reason, though, in the Batcave Companion by Michael Urie and Michael Cronenberg, which is a wonderful Tomorrow's book, Len Wein said, and this may have been from a previous interview, but it was printed there. He said he wanted to create a new villain, but Julius Schwartz challenged him to come up with a new version of Clayface. So Julius Schwartz said, you got to come up with a new Clayface. He was pretty happy with the result. And it just now popped in my head. Julius Schwartz, to my knowledge, never used the Matt Hagen Clayface. I mean, I think after the new look Batman came into vogue in the 1964, I think he had made maybe an appearance or two in World's Finest, which was under Mort Weisinger. And he was still kind of using some of the Silver Age Batman tropes, the previous Silver Age, the sci-fi Batman era tropes and characters. But Clayface was on, Matt Hagen, was on the 1977 Filmation Batman animated series that had The New Adventures of Batman, that had Adam West and Burt Ward reprising the roles, doing the voices. So maybe because he was being used on that, Julie Schwartz wanted to keep that name going and challenged Lin Wein to come up with a new Clayface. That's the only thing I can figure.
Okay, I get it. All right, that tracks. I can kind of see that. Because, yeah, before we mentioned it, I was like, why would Julie Schwartz care if, like, they needed to make a new Clayface? Like, why?
Yeah.
Well, apparently he was destined to have a much larger multimedia presence.
You know? Right. I mean, he's got a movie that's being filmed right now. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's crazy. But, yeah, I'm going to stick with Professor Payne from now on. I like that. Yeah. So.
That's amazing. Okay, I don't know who Siskoid's next guest is on who's editing, but, you know, yeah, I think he does.
I did it once before, but yeah, I guess I could again. Yeah. I will say, though, and I really, this is a great story. I love the Marshall Rogers art, and I've always liked Lin Wein as a writer. Even though apparently Lin Wein is, you know, isn't above robbing an aquarium, because that's clearly a caricature of him that Batman's beating the living hell out of at the beginning of this story. And apparently Marshall Rogers didn't like working with Lin Wein. He didn't like the Marvel method. He was used to having the full scripts from Englehart, and I guess he said he didn't really care for the way that Wein wrote Batman, which is why I guess he doesn't stick around beyond this storyline. So unfortunately, but yeah, I like this comic, but I don't know. Did you notice, where did you read this comic from?
The first time I read it was in the Marshall Rogers hardcover collection. I don't remember if it was Legends of the Dark Knight or Tales of Batman, but
yeah,
it would have been in that either. No, yeah. I read the Marshall Rogers one before the Lin Wein collection. So yeah, it would have been that.
Okay. Cause the Lin Wein collection, I've got the original comic, but I didn't dig it out for this, but I looked at the Lin Wein Tales of the Batman, Lin Wein, and I also read it on DC Universe Infinite, and both of the reproduction of Marshall Rogers, you know, very in Dick Giordano's fine lines and a lot of the process they use with the dots.
Ziptone?
The Ziptone. Guys, I've had a really rough day. I literally broke up a dog fight like right before we started recording, so I apologize.
cut Chris a break. It's been a day.
It's been a day. It's been a day. So I apologize. Zippertone. Yes, thank you. That does not reproduce well in that book, or especially online. It looks horrible. I'm really surprised that DC, like, this is a very, you know, I know it's kind of adjacent to the very important Englehart Rogers run, but still, it's a pretty important Batman comic from a pretty important era, and it's like, it looks like really bad. You need to fix that, DC. You take another pass at that, or just scan in a comic. You know, just scan in a pretty comic. But yeah, it's really bad. I will say, I like, you know, Batman really does, he does lose it, you know, with those guys. Like I said, it kind of reminded me of a Mike W. Barr Batman. You know,
He has no compassion for the cowardly criminal lot. He's just, he doesn't just want to inflict terror. He wants to hit them hard enough that they don't try this again. And he is just, this Batman is going through some stuff right now.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of funny because, you know, I know we have talked many times on here, and we talked about when the trailer for The Batman, the Matt Reeves The Batman, came out, we were like, oh, he looks like he just likes to beat the hell out of people, you know, and we don't like that in our Batman generally. But he's kind of got a good reason. I mean, you know, this really shows what Silver meant to him. But like you said,
they also make a point of saying, like, this is an extreme. Like, the cops aren't used to seeing Batman act like this. Like,
it's not normal. And I like that the cop knows, like, he's been around Batman enough to know that he doesn't normally act like that. That's a nice bit of world building, you know, some of these cops are the same, you know, it's the same cops that he's interacted with before. I like that, you know, and it's not a Bullock or a Montoya who aren't even really around yet. It's especially Montoya, but it's not any of those characters, but it's just your average beat cop, but he has experience with Batman. I like that.
Yeah.
And then I love our face reveal of Clayface 3 during the robbery at Star Labs. It reminds me of, you know, the Phantom of the Opera a bit, maybe more appropriately Vincent Price in House of Wax, or the earlier Mystery of the Wax Museum with Lionel Atwell. You know, it's got that, you know, just that great disfigured, you know, I mean, his face literally looks like it's just melting clay, even more so than Matt Hagen's clay face, you know.
Is there a comic book character named Wax Man? That could be another alternate. I'm still digging Professor Payne, but like Wax Man or something.
Yeah, there you go. That would work too. You know, I always kind of thought, you know, I think later artists draw the headpiece, which of course Marshall Rogers designed all this because he co-created this character. But the headpiece is more of like a dome, kind of like the Superpowers era Mr. Freeze, or like any Mr. Freeze, really. But
right.
But kind of like that. But here, I think in that Batman annual, it looks almost more like a bag, like a heavy containment, like suit, like a radiation suit lens type thing. But it's like the whole thing. It almost looks more like a bag than like a hard, like glass.
Right, because it seems to be more conforming around his natural facial features. It's kind of like more conformed to that rather than just a solid piece that would allow his head to kind of move inside it.
I like that better because not only does it, it's grosser. It also says, wow, this guy really would just like ooze away if it wasn't for the suit. You know, he is literally a mess. Like it's almost like he has to literally pour himself into the suit, you know, which is like, ugh, you know, just
you invoked the name, but this version of Clayface or Professor Payne has always reminded me of, in particular, the more modern and the animated series version of Mr. Freeze, because his suit is more technologically based. It's like a powered suit. It's a containment suit that's keeping him alive. But we also see that his origin story, I think, is a little bit Marvel-esque, like a little bit of Spider-Man villain, but also a little bit more like Victor Freeze's origin as told in the Batman animated series.
Yeah, very true. And I've always thought the superpowers designed for Mr. Freeze from that era seemed like it owed quite a bit to this design, because that was the first time they really put Mr. Freeze in like an armored suit, you know?
Yeah.
And there's things that, you know, it wouldn't take much to take a Superpowers or a Toy Biz Mr. Freeze and make a Clayface 3, which I'm sure plenty of customizers have done.
I thought about it. It was on my docket as a project to work on, but I never got around to it.
Ah, cool. Yeah. So Batman returns to the Wayne Foundation penthouse, and he holds his cape up to it like he's like sour. So like everything's gone sour, but does his cape like stink? You know, it's like, does Batman have ring around the collar? You know, but that was the thing. That was the thing in the 70s. You know, it was a big problem in the 1970s, ring around the collar. I've always thought that was like, I could just, the way that panel looked, it's like, ooh, I just imagine Batman's, all that cape smelling like sweat. It's like, ugh, you know, just...
The guys, the Len Wein stand-in that he beat up had some bad BO, and it's just clinging to his costume.
Oh, yeah, that might be it. Yeah, maybe that's it. And I love that he looks at the picture of Silver, which, just like only in movies and comics do people autograph pictures to each other. Have you ever had anybody autograph a picture to you? I mean, really? With a note? I mean...
I never thought about that.
I mean, it says, you know, love you always and always. Those two kinky kids, you know, we talked about that before. They couldn't even wait till Silver got out of the hospital. You know, Dick had to like stand at the door while they were he and Inishia to keep people out, you know. So it's, you know.
Yeah, that's like the type of thing you would do if like you knew you were never going to see him again, or like you were going away for a long time. But like, when did she give him the picture? Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm going to be thinking about that.
Yeah. And then we get the scene that it's quite shocking that, you know, Bruce Wayne like rails at the portrait of Thomas and Martha Wayne. And he's like, this is all your fault. You, my dear departed parents. If you hadn't died, there would never have been any need for the Batman. I could have lived a normal life like any other man. I could have. Oh, my God. Forgive me. You know, I mean, it's just like, I mean, he's like got his fist up and it's a very Dick Giordano only looking Bruce Wayne profile right there. That looks straight Giordano to me. That looks like he's like, I know how to draw Batman. I'm just going to draw over top this guy. That's but that's pretty shocking. Yeah. What did you think of that?
I was trying to think if we've ever gotten a scene like this before. Like, yeah, there's always been like the scenes of him making the vow, like talking to his parents' gravestone or sometimes their portraits. And like, we know like from like the Mask of the Phantasm when he's begging them to release him from his vow. Mm-hmm. So he can kind of just pursue a life of kind of normal happiness with this woman. But to actually see him so enraged, like you gotta feel like this was in him somewhere, and maybe it was just something that he suppressed and he knew it was irrational to kind of think of that. But at some point, like he must have been thinking like, damn, like this is the, if they had survived, I wouldn't have to be putting myself through this. And why couldn't it happen? And like almost victim blaming essentially. And yeah. Just kind of lashing out of the frustration of it. And he instantly regrets it, obviously. And he's wrong and he knows he's wrong, but and for this to come to him anyway, there must have been, I assume, some part of him that has had this thought or this feeling before.
Yeah. And the next panel inspired a whole movie because he said, maybe it's time I quit being the Batman forever. So Batman forever. And he's thinking about quitting. So, you know, which I mean, I know Steve Englehart has never been very happy that they pretty much strip mined a lot of from his run for the movies without paying him. So, well, they might've gotten a little bit of Lin Wein too there. So, you know, who knows? Mm-hmm. I don't, I like the wrinkle that Gordon knew the cop and he was a mentor to him. That's a nice angle. It makes the death of the guy that much more real that, you know,
right. Yeah, it humanizes the victim, which a lot of times in these comics the bad guy has to kill somebody so we can get that early victim. But this is like, oh, this was actually a person with a history and a connection to our heroes. It makes them more relevant.
Yeah, that's a nice bit. We cut to the wax museum and Wien does a great job describing it and, you know, how the kids would sneak in and look and they'd run away. And I really like that. It gets this kind of like it's, you know, you makes you wonder how long has this place been abandoned. But I like that we see that there's still wax figures inside. You know, there's a figure of Lincoln. There's I don't know who the other person is. Looks maybe like a pirate or something. I don't know who that is next to him. There's a Julius Caesar. It's really nice. And I do like, we get the panel of, he's got a lab in there. You can see all the beakers and test tubes and this is Marshall Rogers getting to use his architecture background again to good use.
Yep. Yeah.
And we meet, Helena just from the back. We don't know anything about her yet. Of course, if you know anything about Clayface 3, you know what's going on here, but, you know, either way, we'll get to that. So,
right, and we covered a follow-up story to this about Clayface 3 a long time ago on an earlier episode of Batman Nightcast.
And then the Secret Origin story that's a follow-up to that, at least, you know, in partially. Yeah. So this is a great story to cover during October because Clayface does, he's got that Marvel bit about him, but he does also seem like a tragic universal monster in a lot of ways. And Payne has acromegaly, which afflicted Rondo Hatton, who starred in Universal B Pictures, particularly as the Brute Man. And he is also who the Rondo Awards are named after, the horror awards. And they not only riffed on him in an episode of Batman the Animated Series, one of somebody's henchmen looked like Rondo Hatton with his, you know, extreme features, big jaw, big lips, you know, because he had the acromegaly. Yeah, yeah. And he was also somebody made up to look like him as a henchman in The Rocketeer. So, yeah. Rondo Hatton keeps getting around, you know, which.
Yeah,
he was, I think he, if not to derail this, but I didn't bone back up on Rondo Hatton, but I believe he was a journalist later in life, this really started to affect him. I mean, his jaw, his bones just began to grow, and he got this face that looked like something that, looked like a makeup almost. So they're like, well, let's, he used it to his advantage to have a career in these horror films and thrillers. And I believe he appeared in one of the Sherlock Holmes movies too. But he's well remembered, and that whenever anybody says acromegaly, I immediately think of Rondo Hatton. So yeah. I do wonder, though, we talk about Matt Hagen, and he sees back up a little bit. That one panel side profile of young Matt Hagen on the school bus, that's just so sad. Young Preston Payne is just so sad. It's Rogers does a good job of making him look different, but he's not like, monstrous looking or anything, but he looks different enough that you understand the kids would shun him, pick on him, which is horrible, of course, but but it's really sad. You really do feel for this guy. But he goes and sees Matt Hagen because he sees that news article, a headline about Batman apprehending Clayface. He's not willing to tell him where he got his Clayface powers, like the pond that, that he gets that mystical pond that he gets the pool in the cave or whatever that he gets the powers from. But he is willing to give him a blood sample. It's kind of weird, don't you think? I just found that odd. I don't know. Then he, of course, like any scientist, like the lizard, which Cindy and I just covered on House of Frankenstein, he tests his formula on himself, and he goes out on the town, and again, this is, a lot of these pages have Marshall Rogers patented a way of shoving like 15 panels into one page. But it works, and the woman, when he grabs her, is a very Dick Giordano woman as well, his date. And he looks really, in that last panel, his hair's all like gone back and his head's all lumpy. Right. Really hideous. And the next page, I mean, it's really disturbing because he's holding on to her arm, and you can basically see he's holding on to her, the bones of her arm.
Yeah, as the skin is peeling off, melting off.
Yeah, it's just melting off her bones. It's like, oh my God, that's just, I mean, if you really think about this, I mean, think about if you saw this in a film, what this would look like, holy cow. I mean, yeah, it's disturbing. And definitely that big shot of his face, you can definitely see that it is more of like a containment bag versus a hard shell helmet type thing. Yeah. But,
James Gunn has done some, kind of like creature and body horror movies in the past, and we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the plot of this Clayface movie. So maybe.
Yeah, that's true. He might be combining the two Clayfaces, that would be, or two of them anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. I love the reveal of Helena. It even though I knew it still packs a punch. I love the, she looks very plastic, the way that Rogers drew her and the coloring, it's obviously it's a wax figure, well, not plastic. She looks wax, whatever, but sometimes she's a mannequin. Sometimes she's a wax figure. I know, but,
there's a great bit of dramatic irony too, because, as we get this reveal, he says, "Without you, sweet Helena, I would have certainly gone mad." It's like,
yes, yes,
I think
I love
you're there,
that.
Buddy.
Yeah, you're already on the train to Crazy Town, buddy. I'm sorry, but it's and it's kind of weird though that they went with the name Helena, since the Huntress was a big thing in and there was obviously she's connected to Batman, so I know it's over on Earth too, but it is kind of weird that they went with that name since they already have a Helena, and that I think around this time, I can't remember if it's happened yet, but no, it hasn't happened yet, because it happens in one of the dollar comics of I think it's after Batman Family and merges with Detective and it becomes a dollar comic that the Earth One Batman and Robin meet the Huntress. So they haven't met her yet. So
okay.
Sorry, me and my Earth Two getting in the way, but I like the panels at the bottom of page 15 of him pulling the door open, the gate, you know, like he's I like they show his boot up against the door, which that's a nice touch. These really, you know, it's just like a series of five panels that he pulls the door. That's and then a crunk. That's a nice bit.
With the title of this and with that like series of panels just focusing on his hand pulling it, I just see the caption Clayface is coming, like a doomsday homage to
yes.
The first appearance.
That's right. Yeah. He's gonna, you know, eventually you'll see the bone coming through the glove, the knuckles, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that, you know, he's got, you know, we kind of, not that you need to get into all the detail of his costume, but he's got his index finger is its own separate hole for his glove, you know, and then his other three fingers, his index finger and his thumb are separate, but then the other three fingers are grouped into like a mitten almost,
yeah.
Which I think it almost kind of makes sense considering he's, you know, turning to goo all the time, but... Mm-hmm. We get some nice capage of on the bottom of page 16 of both Batman and Clayface because
yep.
Nobody drew better capage than Marshall Rogers. If you think somebody did, fight me. That's all I've listeners. I mean, without it going, I mean, yes, he exaggerated a little bit, but he really didn't that much. He just Batman's cape's long and this is how it moves. And better than Neil Adams, better than. You know, anybody else you can think of, you know, George Perez did great capage too when he got to draw Batman, but I still stand by Marshall Rogers, king of Batman capage. But so the ending's pretty abrupt. I'm like, wait, is that the end? What?
Did they just run out of pages?
Yeah, exactly. It kind of felt like that. I'm like, I know this is the month before the DC explosion / implosion because the next issue, like beginning of this issue, Hawkman, one issue. And then the DC implosion happens, or maybe two. But yeah, then the implosion happens. So it's only 17 pages. So pretty short story for a lead comic. But yeah, Batman. You know, the fever seems to strike Preston Payne when he's just about to leave a room. He has to turn around and go. It's kind of like when you really, you know, I don't really have to pee, but I better pee before I leave. Right. You know, it's kind of yeah. Like, and I'm older than you, so I know that more. But as you get older, that you'll be like, yeah, before I leave and get in a car, I better pee. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a good one. I'm looking forward. Of course, I've read it before, but I'm looking forward to covering the next one because I think Clayface 3's a great character. I think he had a lot of potential that they didn't do. They honestly haven't done a lot with him unless they've done more with him in recent years. I know the animated series kind of made it go back to Matt Hagen, which is fine. And I love their take on Matt Hagen. But, you know, I think Preston Payne had a lot of, we'll get into that next time, but I think he had a lot more potential than what we saw, unfortunately.
I agree, but I also think there's something about him. I can see this version of Clayface sort of transcending the Batman world and kind of becoming a utility DC villain where you could put this guy up against a lot of different heroes. Certainly more street level, but like, yeah, he could have fought the aforementioned Hawkman or something like that.
That'd be cool. Yeah, I mean, he could be hanging out in Carter Hall's museum making time with one of the statues there, and you know, then he has to fight Hawkman.
there you go
writes itself. Well, that's all I got for this one. What about you?
I really liked it. Just flipping through it again, I think my favorite page is that one with the first face reveal of Clayface. I think you're absolutely right. It's such a gruesome, such a cool little shock and reveal. Yeah, it's fun. I'm looking forward to the next one too.
Yeah, me too. I just Marshall Rogers did not draw enough Batman, and I'm always up for a Len Wein story, no matter what he's writing. It's always entertaining, I'm looking forward to the next one. I wish it continued on after that, but you know, we know it doesn't. So, we'll make do with what we got. That's for sure.
There you go.
Okay, we'll take a quick promo break and then we'll come back with Batman and Robin Year 2, Number 2.
It's 1986. The Masters of Evil have a plan to crush the Avengers. They succeed. Can our heroes fight their way back to victory and defeat the Masters? Join me, Tim Price, and an assemblage of some of Earth's mightiest podcasters as we cover Avengers Under Siege, issue by issue, plus tie-ins, celebrating the 40th anniversary of the greatest Avengers story ever. The show, Outcasters Under Siege, coming in 2026. Point your podcatcher to the Right On Network.
Batman and Robin Year 1, Issue 2. It was released November 20th, 2024. It's just called Chapter 2. The plot is by Mark Waid and Chris Samnee. The script was by Mark Waid. The art was by Chris Samnee. Colors are by Giovanna Nero. Letters by Clayton Cowles with Chris Samnee. And the editors were Andrew Marino and Rob Levin. Batman and Robin's partnership is starting to strain from the stress of Bruce's strict standards. He expects Robin to approach threats like he does, with precision and efficiency, not the flash and the style of Dick's natural showmanship. But the most immediate threat to the dynamic duo's partnership might be Laura Lynn, Dick's case manager from Child Protective Services. Bruce assures her that, as an orphan himself, he takes Dick's safety and well-being seriously. When Laura finds Dick literally swinging from the chandeliers of Stately Way Manor, however, she warns Bruce that her check-ins will continue and they won't always come with notice in advance. Two-Face goes to see Gotham's newest player, General Grimaldi, offering a business partnership. He'll give the general the mysterious and super important police file he stole in exchange for Grimaldi taking him on as his second in command. Batman and Robin head out on their nightly patrol as Batman reveals that the Batcave is vastly larger than Robin thought. Batman uses the system of caverns running beneath Gotham, with entry points at abandoned buildings owned by Bruce Wayne located all around the city. This grants Batman and Robin the ability to show up wherever they're needed without potential threats seeing the Batmobile coming from miles away, which is handy considering a guy tried to ambush the Batmobile just last issue. A truck full of Sal Maroni's goons is en route to torch a Falcone meth lab when one of the Maroni goons betrays the others, incinerating them in the truck. The flaming truck crashes into an apartment building, which catches fire. Batman and Robin spring quickly to evacuate the residents, but Robin goes back in to save a couple of kids. For a brief moment, Batman is terrified that the blaze will overcome his partner. Just then, however, the boy wonder emerges safely and in spectacular fashion with the two children. Afterwards, Batman questions the only Maroni thug still breathing, barely. Just before he dies, he tells Batman they were torched by Tommy Moretti, an otherwise totally loyal soldier in Maroni's army, and that as Tommy was burning them, his face was melting like wax.
It's Wax Man.
I was going to say, I was leaving it up to you, man. It's only teased at the end of this one. We don't get it, but spoilers for the people who will be following along who aren't reading the story. We will be getting Clayface in this. And it was not my intention when we started this to coordinate two Clayface stories while a Clayface movie is also in production right now. Like, this is kind of... Well, a little bit more serendipitous, but I guess Clayface was in the zeitgeist right now.
Yeah, it would have made more sense if we waited till the movie came out, but you know, like the Superman movie. But yeah, you know, we're ahead of the curve here, so
yeah. Exactly. So you can thank us when the movie is awesome.
That's right. Yeah, when Fire and Water Network makes it happen again. So. Again.
What did you think of the whole opening with the Child Protective Services scene? With Laura in their office, and the rest of the staff is basically starting a betting pool on when, you know, the foppish Bruce Wayne will just collapse and his adoption of this young kid will crash and embarrass them.
This is, I love this because, you know, this is what would actually happen. Because, I mean, with Bruce Wayne being the, you know, his reputation preceding him. And I mean, we are, I guess, still riffing on the Batman year one version here. So that was very much a part of, you know, when Gordon came to his house and he had the model with him that didn't speak English and, you know, didn't understand what he was saying and all that. And, you know, he had the apple cider or whatever that was supposed to be wine or what, you know, all that business. Yep. I mean, he projected that much like Christian Bale in Batman Begins, the total just irresponsible rich boy. And so, yeah, him adopting or, you know, taking in a ward or whatever you want to call it nowadays, that, I mean, that would definitely raise the ire of, you know, these type of people. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure they're good. They have good intentions for the kids and everything, but they're also human. They're also a little bit cynical and they also need to, you know, kill time. So they're going to do goofy things like this. I like it. Laura seems to be drawn to look like Lauren Bacall.
I didn't notice that when I was reading it, but now I see it.
Yeah, I just, I'm like, oh, Lauren Bacall. There you go. But, you know, hey, if, you know, Batman in year one was, he's not so much here by Samney, but my Mazzucchelli, he was drawn to look like Gregory Peck. So, hey, why not? You know?
I wonder if that was just Samney's sort of casting as he was drawing it, or if Mark Waid had any involvement in that.
I don't know. I do like that she calls it Stately Wayne Manor, though. I love that.
Exactly. Yeah. I know. That's the best part. Stately Wayne Manor, yeah. And of course, we this brilliant transition because now she's Dick's new case manager. She's going to head out to the mansion to see him. And she's like, I just, you know, making sure that Bruce isn't putting the boy in danger. Cut to machine guns just as our title page, machine guns. And then we get this, you know, sort of double spread of different panels. Robin is basically just leaping, avoiding these machine gun fire, but it's not under threat. Like, this is all just a training regime in the Batcave, and he's bouncing off of like the different, yeah, we'll talk about this, but some of like the trophies and the other accoutrement in the Batcave. And Bruce is telling him basically, you're screwing up, you're doing it wrong, you're wasting time. And Robin's like, I'm doing fine. I haven't been shot yet. Just lay off. And you really see them kind of like what Bruce expects of him, his standards. But Robin's like, dude, I'm doing what you need.
Yeah. I mean, he makes it through, but because he doesn't do it the way Bruce wants him to, he gets upset. But yeah, we brought this up last time. Batman has every single trophy in the Batcave already.
Yeah.
I mean, the Laughing Fish. The Laughing Fish. Dick was in college in Earth One continuity when the Laughing Fish happened. He kicks the Laughing Fish, which is apparently in some kind of tub there, kicks them into the machine gun barrel. And that's how he stops it. And it, I mean, that's, don't get me wrong, it's great. I'm not here to nitpick continuity to death because, I mean, continuity does not matter anymore. It really doesn't. I read Mark Waid's new DC of the History Universe, and yeah, it's a fun book, good book, but it's like, oh, they just like, okay, this part happened from here and this part happened from there. And I don't even know where this part came from, but I mean, it's a good read. I recommend it, but at the same time, it's, yeah, like, so it doesn't matter. But yeah, it's like the Joker card's there. All the Penguin's umbrellas are there. The Laughing Fish, you know, everything you can. The Riddler's got a big giant box. I love the Mad Hatter's hat. Is the David Wayne Batman 66 Mad Hatter with the super instant mesmerizer. Yes.
Yeah.
And the monk's hood. Now that makes sense. The monk was pre-Robin.
The monk, Robin, he grabs the Penguin's umbrella, but it also looks like Riddler's cane is in there. There's like swords that, you know, might have belonged to the Cavalier or Captain Stingray or something like that. So, there's a bunch of stuff in there. I guess Batman and Robin year one is like Batman year 7, 8, something like that.
Sure seems like it. Yeah, I mean, he's been awful busy, you know.
Right. At the same time, I don't care. This doesn't bother me. It doesn't take me out of the story. I like the color, the flash that it adds to the story. I'm kind of fine with it. It's fine.
No, it doesn't bother me either. We talked about that last time. Yeah, it's fun to see all these, and it's such a beautiful double page spread, like you said, and like you said, I really love that. We mentioned this last time. I really love the colors in this series.
Yeah. They're really good. Yeah. Once the interview starts going, Bruce is walking Laura through the manor. We actually see, we get Alfred is in the kitchen washing dishes by hand. And I like that over the decades, it's been building upon who Alfred is and how his background and how detailed. It's like, what makes him qualified to do all of these things for Batman that he does? But Bruce actually just lays it all out here. He's like, he's not just a butler or a housekeeper. He's trained as a medic. He's a nutritionist, a master chief, or master chef, sorry. Not just trained as a medic. He's like a battlefield surgeon, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, he's, you know, he's also a secret agent and, you know, all this and that, but, you right. know, we don't need to get into that. But yeah, I love that bit. Yeah. It's, and I like that Bruce is open about that he's a trauma survivor, because
yeah,
that would obviously be public record, you know,
right.
You know,
right. Yeah.
But it's like he doesn't try to, you know, hide it. And I mean, he uses it as an advantage. He's like, you know, even somebody like him, all he has to say is, well, this kid went through the same thing I did. And that's right. why I'm trying to help him. And that would be like the kind of the hand wave that gets him in the door anyway, you know. And I like that. It's not like, you know, like Vicki Vale finding out, oh, Bruce Wayne's parents were murdered. No, everybody knows. I mean, she was from out of town in the movie. But right, and yes, right. I said Vicki Vale.
Vicki Vale.
I like that it's, you know, he knows everybody knows it. And he's like just being open about it. I like their conversation.
I also like when, you know, he's talking about all the things that Alfred is equipped to do, and she, not so subtly, she's like, how much time does Alfred spend with the boy? And Bruce's like, oh, that's your way of suggesting that he's the one doing the raising of the child while I'm just out there, you know, playing, you know, polio or something, or polo, sorry, not polio. But it's interesting that she does kind of hit upon that, because Alfred does have a paternal relationship with all of the Robins, whether it be yeah. as a sort of surrogate father or grandfather. You know, Bruce's relationship with them sort of vacillates between adoptive or surrogate father and big brother as they kind of grow older, especially with Dick sort of as time goes on.
Right.
Yeah, Alfred, he's always kind of the constant. He is more a little bit of a father or a grandfather to that sense. So the familial yeah. connection. When she's like, is it really Alfred doing the raising of the children? I mean, in some ways, yes, that is kind of what happens.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can say Bruce never really grew up. He literally suffers from arrested development. He's still
right.
that
yeah. Yeah.
angry little boy, you know, in a lot of ways. So,
yeah.
And especially modern comics, you know. So Alfred does have to be yeah. the adult in the room.
So, I mean, a little tangent. In modern comics, they've killed off Alfred. He was killed off at the end of Tom King's run. Initially, I thought, okay, that's dumb. It's just done for shock value. I hated the decision, and I hadn't read it for a long time. I have read that issue, but I haven't read a whole lot of Tom King's run. A little bit bigger picture, stepping aside from it, I can kind of see a purpose for what it was done and how it affects Damian in particular as a character, because Damian has a very particular relationship with Alfred that has been developing over the last decade or so. Now, if you're not a fan of Damian Wayne, you don't care about that, but just sort of giving you that heads up.
Yeah, I know.
But
yeah.
A trend that I saw in a lot of the more modern Batman comics, especially when because I read Chip Zdarsky's run, who came after James Tynion, who came after Tom King, and it really seemed like they were doing a lot of things in the comics over the last couple of years to distance the idea that Batman and Bruce Wayne are billionaires, or is a billionaire, maybe just because we don't have the same love and affection for billionaires like we used to. As a culture and a society, and maybe it's hard to sympathize with him that way. So they do things like take away his fortune at different times, or do other things. And I think maybe just taking away his butler, his manservant, is a way of kind of reducing the sense that he is sort of like an ultra elite part of society that would not deign to look down on us as kind of peasants. So that's just a weird little tangent, but this story, this series in particular, just reminds Alfred does. That's not just being the butler. That's not just reminding us of who Bruce Wayne is, how rich he is, that he lives in this mansion, but it's just this voice, this contrast that he gives. And we see that through, I'm forecasting a little bit, but we see this throughout the series. Alfred cannot so subtly well, actually, sorry, Alfred can very subtly play devil's advocate with Bruce, even when he's changing opinions and coming down on the opposite side of certain arguments, just as a way of challenging Bruce and making sure that he's thinking about it from all the angles. Yeah, you need characters like that. You need somebody who's not always in the costume. He can be the voice of reason and caution at times. So.
Yeah, I haven't read the new Batman. I bought it, the new Batman number one, but I think there's, spoiler warning, isn't there like a hologram Alfred like or something?
That's what I've heard. I haven't read it yet either. I want to, but I just haven't gotten it.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's like, yeah, just retcon that and bring it back. It's time, you know, it's like, you know, it's like eventually you're going to, so nobody stays dead like that. Somebody's going to bring it back. And I mean, I know there were some good stories that came out of it. I mean, I think it like brought Bruce and Dick closer together again. And I guess all the Robins in some ways, you know, cause like you said, he had a hand in raising all of them. And of course, Bruce. So, you know, I mean, that's not a bad story to explore, but long run, you know, I think you need Alfred. I think he's a necessary component. There's a reason why every version of Batman has, you know, every film version has to have an Alfred, and they usually get a pretty big actor to play them now. You know, it's like they are some distinguished yeah. actor, or, you know, pretty a name, somebody you recognize, you know. So yeah, he's integral to the character in just as much, if in my opinion, more than Commissioner Gordon. I know not modern comics say, oh no, you know, Gordon, because of Batman Year One and everything. But in my mind, Alfred's right. more important than Gordon. You can, you know, get rid of Gordon and it doesn't change the dynamic as much as it if you get rid of Alfred. I don't want to get rid of either one of them, but you know, so that's just me.
And then we have the best scene in the book by a mile, because he's still walking Laura through the house and he's like, I assure you, the kid is just fine. I'm keeping him totally safe. And they open the door and he is swinging from chandelier to chandelier, flipping upside down and just going, hi. and her jaw drops and Bruce is just scowling. And
yes,
and he's like, no, no, please hold your applause until, and he does this dramatic flourish, landing on the cushion of the chair, which is kicking up dust as he lands.
Yeah, Alfred's not doing a very good job of dusting then, is he? He's like, you know, because he's busy, you know, firing rubber bullets instead of dusting, you know, but yeah. I love how the seat cushions crumpled under his weight. I love that. That's
yep.
great.
Yep, yep.
My favorite panel in this whole book is when she looks away and Bruce has the fist up and the look on his face like, why I oughta, you know, just, I mean, like, I think it's almost Homer Simpson getting ready to choke out Bart, you know, I mean, it's that yeah, little, yeah. It's, you know, and then in the next panel, he's, yeah, why you little, it's just, yeah, exactly. And he's got his arm around him like, hey, you know, I never noticed before, but they even in some panels color their skin color a little different. Bruce and Dick, they've got like Dick's more dark complected than Bruce, which uh-huh. I like, because it's like, yeah. you know, that's, you know, it's a nice nod and to, you know, Bruce doesn't get out in the sun much, right? You know,
right,
yeah. Dick probably will lose a little bit of that tan before too long too, right? So mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah. Also, maybe he's just flushed because the blood is rushing to his head because he's been upside down.
That's true, too. Yeah, and he's been exerting himself. That's true. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
I like this angle that child services is kind of getting involved, because you're right. That's something that would – and I don't remember if we've seen this in a Batman story or not. It kind of seems like maybe we have. But, yeah, I like that she's like, I'll be back for additional interviews. You know, this is a long process that's going to continue. And my visits won't always, you know, come with advance notice. You know, I might just do a spot random. And for a superhero trying to hold a secret identity and maintain that this is a not insignificant threat that she poses.
Right. Yeah. It's such a, and it's not something that Batman, there's nothing he can do about it. There's not, I mean, it's not some villain he can punch. It's, you know, right. it's not some right. trap he can get out of, you know, it's literally, it's bureaucracy and I mean, and he can't, and I'm sure there's a part of him that's like, you know, they're doing their job and it's an important job. So I you know, he probably doesn't, he could probably some way, you know, try to grease some palms and make this woman go away. But at the same time, he probably, because he is Batman and he's Bruce Wayne, he's you know, actually a good person at heart. He probably doesn't want to do that, you know, so.
Then we see our new villain, General Grimaldi. He's in his hideout. He's eating and talking to his father. Doesn't have the greatest relationship with the man, but he's keeping him alive at least.
Then they get
a visit from Harvey Dent, aka Two-Face. And this is where Dent makes his pitch, because we saw him last issue and he was like, "You don't know what kind of trouble is heading for you, Batman. This guy is serious." And here he's like, "You know, I'll give you this important file that I stole, and I'll help you. And I know this city better than you do. I know it better than your goons do. So let me do this for you, give you this information. And in return, you take me on as your second in command." I like that because it's Two-Face.
Yeah. And he seems so hurt when he says, "I'll consider it." And he's like, "Consider, you know, I mean, it looks like he's like kind of scared and kind of hurt in that last panel, both Harvey and Two-Face, you know?"
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's I'm a big deal. Do you know who I am that you're just turning away like this? Yeah.
Yeah. I have action figures made of me. Don't you know? I was made into a McDonald's glass. Come on. You know, it's
God, how much do those glasses cost to make? Those things were insane.
Oh, I know. It's I've still got, I think I got two sets, because I kept picking one up here and there when it's like, it's a quarter, you know, or something. People sell them at a yard sale. But they're almost like they're made out of, you know, like quartz or something. I don't know. It's like a Swarovski, you know, Batman glass from McDonald's or something. Yeah.
Then we get this really cool sequence where the bat boat, the little bat submarine, pops up into a cave, like a bat cave, and Robin is confused. He's like, "We just left the bat cave." He's like, "Do you have more than one?" He's like, "No, I just have one really big bat cave. It's much bigger than you think." Yeah, there are caves that run all underneath Gotham City, and he's got connections. He's got tunnels and caves and spots set up, and little like safe houses and buildings around the city that Bruce Wayne owns, so that he can keep people out of them, and these serve as entry and exit points when he needs them. So, what'd you think about this?
Oh, I love this. I think this is a brilliant idea. I mean, this is one of the things Mark Waid has always been fantastic about. He takes elements that have been there for years, and he takes the idea of, okay, Batman had the Batcave under Wayne Manor. He had the Batcave under the Wayne Foundation building. He had some of the other little hidden Batcaves during No Man's Land, right? Well, they're all connected. It's a network of caves that run like literally all underneath Gotham City. So Batman can pop out anywhere he needs to, you know, which, I mean, they kind of did that in the 90s with the subway rocket thing that Azrael found and used as Batman.
Yeah.
So they kind of did that then, but this is more like literally all of the underneath of Gotham City is the Batcave. That's pretty freaking awesome.
Yeah. Then we get a little action beat where these guys from the Maroni crime family are driving a truck. They've all got blow torches because they're going to torch a rival, the Falcone mob's meth lab. And while they're just talking about it, one of the guys just turns on the others and he's got this crazy smile. And they're like, "What are you doing?" And he just whoosh, burns them down.
That is gruesome.
Then, and then the whole truck starts ablaze. Guys are screaming as the truck kind of wheels out of control and slams into a building. And then the building is on fire. And they're like, "We got to get people out." It's a little bit hard to find like what's going on during this sequence, like these pages when it crashes, like what part of the building, because then it looks like maybe it crashed into a restaurant, but there are apartments above it because there's a shot of like this guy like who's like in a windshield, but it's like on a kitchen table or something like that, and he's helping and Batman's pulling them out. Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely, I had to go back and look because yeah, there's a plate of food, and then we see the driver that we saw before. He's laying on, like you said, the he's through the windshield, he's on the hood, but that has also crashed into tables in a restaurant. We see people running away, and there's more food on the table. It is a little you got to kind of go back and look, and I'm like, wait a minute, why is there a plate of look like, I don't know what it is. It looks like mashed potatoes and toast and peas and maybe chicken fried steak. I don't know what that is, but or a piece of chicken. I don't know. It looks like it's got ketchup on it, but yeah, it's maybe it's chicken parmesan. I don't know, but yeah, it's kind of it is a little hard to follow, but it's the fire and everything. It looks of course the colors and the art
I
just
love
make
the
it look great.
yeah, I love the panel, like the sort of second row. It's actually panel four below that of the guy's like, "Help, I'll die." Batman's like, "Not tonight, take my hand." And just that image where you see Batman's eyes and his glove, but like his shape is just kind of amorphous. There's like no hard lines in that. It's just kind of the blur from the smoke around him.
Yeah, and the waves of the heat, it kind of feels it's really, and it makes you think, okay, Batman's costume is probably pretty much fireproof, so that's of course it probably is, but I like that, yeah.
And then I like Robin, and he's like, "Wait, I saw bikes here," which indicates kids, but I don't see any kids. So he runs back in there, and Batman's like, "Let me do it," but it's too late. Robin's already in there, and he gets the kids. He's like, "Don't be afraid, that's my job." And he throws his bulletproof and flame retardant cape over them, and he kind of jury rigs this whole thing with getting a wire in the door. And you see that hair in Batman's face as he's looking, and then the building explodes, and he think he's lost the kid. And then the door slams down, and riding it like a skateboard or a surfboard, using the wire to kind of guide him with these kids in tow, like under the blanket. He's like, "Now presenting the sensational find of the century, the amazing young daredevil, Robin the Magnificent." I love the phrasing of the sensational find of the century, because it goes back to the very first appearance of Robin on the cover, when he's like what is it, the sensational character find of 1940 or something like that.
40, exactly. Yep. I love that part. It's great. It's a great, ta-da, you can hear the Robin theme from the animated series playing when he does that. It's great. And
And
Batman
then,
smiles at him. Yeah, he said, "Thanks again for the cool cape. Don't mention it." He's got a smile on his face.
"Admit it, I had you scared, didn't I?" That was like, "I'd have gotten you out." Like, "You liar." And then they go to the truck to find, like, there's one survivor in the back who's just charred to a corpse, and he's clearly got only seconds to live. And he's like, "Look, don't die in vain. Tell me what happened. Tell me what's going on." And the guy's like, "It was Tommy." And the guy is like, "He went nuts. He started burning us, but his face was melting like wax, man." And this is the last image of Batman looking grim, and Robin behind him like, "Wait, what?" The last panel where it says to be continued, that image of Batman, that looks very Mike Mignola to me.
It does. You're right. Yeah, good point. It does. It very much looks like a bat Mike Mignola Batman. Yeah. And I love Robin's like literally like exact I love the look on his face. I mean, if he wasn't saying wait what, his face is still saying wait what? Just And like it kind of recalls again Sam Neill, especially with Robin, not afraid to go a little like I said, it's almost like the Teen Titans animated series where they'd be normal kind of manga-esque characters, and then all of a sudden they'd turn into little super deformed characters in a moment, and then back again. He's not that extreme, but it does remind me of that somewhat.
Another really good issue. I love this series. I'm having so much fun with it. I'm glad we're covering it. I know a lot of our listeners might not be as in touch with the modern comics, but this one doesn't feel modern. It's got some modern sophistication in terms of its storytelling, but it's not grim dark. It's not cynical. It's a love letter to Batman and Robin in a way, but it's told with a fresh story, a fresh approach, and I like this a lot.
And I think we got a lot of people that really liked the World's Finest series. This is, of course, it's a little grittier. It's a little more urban because it's just Batman, no Superman. But it's got that same vibe. It's got, it feels, it feels like the Golden Age comics, and it feels like Batman Year One, but it also feels like something fresh too. It's really well. I mean, look who's doing it, Mark Waid and Chris Samnee. So it's if you haven't read it, you know, and I'm sure there's a trade coming up very soon, or a hardcover maybe. And they're if you got DC Universe Infinite, I think they're if you've got Ultra anyway, I think they're pretty much all up except of course 12. So you can read them all there, and I can't recommend it enough.
All right. Anything else?
Nope. I think that'll cover it this time. But just, you know, next time, hopefully we'll, you know, see what happens with Professor Payne and Waxman, you know, so. Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. Feedback for this show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire & Water Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, or other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening. I'll stop the world at and it's getting better.